Helen Russell is a best-selling author, journalist and speaker. Formerly editor of MarieClaire.co.uk, turned Scandinavia correspondent for The Guardian, her first book, The Year of Living Danishly, became an international bestseller optioned for television. She's the author of six critically acclaimed books, her most recent being How to Raise a Viking, A Guide to Nordic Parenting.
So that's how it happened. I was coached through it by these Viking teachers around me.
Yeah, it feels very refreshing. What is the thing that you think you've, the sort of, not the best kept secret, I suppose, but the greatest thing that you've learned parenting over there?
I found myself saying this phrase that has gone down in family folklore of, you can have a sore once you're four, to a two-year-old. It's just the norm here. We can't shut ourselves off to that, because then we shut ourselves off to life.
Helen, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. I just want to start by asking, what on earth do you know that I can know and I can really put into action about how to raise children brilliantly, the Viking way?
Well, I would say, first off, I am not the expert. I would never tell anyone how to raise their children, because it is hard. And I am very much the idiot and the student in this. I am purely sharing the knowledge that I have been taught by much wiser parents than me in the Nordic countries over the last 10 years. So there are some quick wins. There are some structural differences that we can kind of lobby for. But I think, I guess, one really quick, easy one is just allowing time for play and not overscheduling, I'd say.
Yeah, that is a danger, isn't it, for parents, and especially in the way in which we live our lives now, where you feel like you've got to fill the day with everything or you're not succeeding, and neither will your child be. So whether it's back-to-back clubs or school as well as clubs, or, you know, whatever it is, just filling the time nonstop. And actually, sometimes I suppose it's just good for them to be bored.
Yeah, really good. I heard recently that apparently imaginary friends are dying out because our kids aren't bored enough to come up with them. So yeah, the Nordic countries are particularly good at, I think, just allowing time for play. They even have two words for play. There's so big they named it twice. There's one for if it's imaginative, unstructured, and then another for if it's like games or music or sports or something. So they're very on it, very focused on play, I'd say.
Well, let's take it back then to how you ended up knowing so much about how to raise children the Viking way, because that is the book that you've just recently launched. And it is fascinating, because different cultures do different things and have different approaches, which we can all learn from in different ways. I spent a portion of time in New Zealand and found myself taking Bellatrix, our four-year-old daughter at the time, into a kindergarten there. And in the playground were axes and were saws in a sort of self-made sort of sand pit. And I thought, you're not honestly going to let me just leave my child here with other four-year-olds as well as, you know, my four-year-old in this environment with wielding sort of saws and things like that with bare feet and everything else. That was the Kiwi way. That's the way they did things. And actually, I had to pull myself together and say, just let her get on with it. And it probably was the best thing I could have done. So what has been, how have you sort of come to experience what you have? I mean, the story in which you ended up in Denmark in the first place, and you've had to sort of learn the Danish way. How did that evolve? How did that come to be?
Yes. So I was living and working in London for 12 years as a journalist. I had no intention of leaving. And then one afternoon, my husband came home and told me he'd been offered a job in Denmark, and not Copenhagen, the bit everyone's heard of, but rural Jutland, working for Lego, the clicky brick company. And I was very skeptical to start with, but Denmark had just been voted the happiest country in the world. So as a journalist, I was kind of fascinated by this. My curiosity was piqued, and I began to research more about it. We didn't have children at the time. I'd been having fertility treatment for years, just seemed never to be possible for us. So we thought we didn't have that much to lose. So we moved, and I decided that we'd try it for a year. So it was only ever meant to be a year-long experiment. And then halfway through my first year, I found out I was finally pregnant. And then I went on to have IVF twins. The twin part was a surprise. So we kind of had a lot of skin in the Viking game, going from not thinking I could have children to having three of them within 3 years. We were really in the deep end, and I very much lent on the wisdom of the Nordic parents around me to learn how to do things, really. So that's how it happened. I was coached through it by these Viking teachers around me.
And did you have a similar sort of reaction to it that I did when I stepped into that nursery in New Zealand that time and thought, oh my goodness, I've actually got to leave my child in this scenario, bare feet, a saw, an axe, whatever other tools there may be lying around, and just sort of walk away from this and be calm about it? I mean, what was your sort of initial take and reaction and feeling about the environment that you were going to be bringing your own children up into?
I mean, yeah, absolute terror. I mean, my natural inclination is to bubble wrap my children, wrap them in cotton wool. In Denmark, they have this famous high levels of trust, and people leave their babies outside to nap in their prams. So when I saw that before I had children, I thought, well, that's absurd and terrifying. And what if someone steals my baby? And then an elderly neighbor pointed out, no one steals babies in Denmark. It's too much like hard work. So I never thought I'd do it. And then one day I kind of did, because all of my Danish mother's group friends were doing it. And then I had twins and I couldn't get a twin pram in anywhere because it's so enormous. So I kind of slowly acclimatized, but similar to you, my children have all attended the terrifying institution known as Family Scouts in Denmark. And that's basically letting toddlers loose with knives and axes. And I found myself saying this phrase that has gone down in family folklore of, you can have a saw once you're four, to a two-year-old. It's just the norm here. But yeah, absolutely took some serious getting used to.
I was going to say, like, the idea of leaving your child in a buggy outside a cafe or whatever it might be while you go in and grab a coffee. I mean, you can't, in the UK, you can't even leave your child in a car seat if you go and pay for fuel at the petrol station. So that is a really alien concept, isn't it? I can understand how that took a really long time to get used to. But why is there this sort of deep sense of trust in the community? Where does it all come from? Where do they get their confidence from that it's going to be okay?
I think that is a real kind of chicken and egg question. And there's actually still quite a lot of debate about that. It's a small country, of course, only 5.8 million, been homogenous until recently. So there is a real sense that people just do trust each other. 79% of Danes trust most people. But they've also found that people arriving in Denmark from low trust societies, including the UK, including other countries we might not think of as perhaps being massively happy, very soon, within a few months, end up adopting these high trust attitudes and score happier in these happiness polls as well. So there's something about the culture, the way they do things here, that helps people to feel more trusting as well. And actually, a lot of the research around risky play and adventure and giving our children that freedom that, as you say, we're so not used to in the UK, a lot of the research comes out of the Nordics, and they found that actually indulging in this risky play is really good for children. It has an antiphobic effect, makes them less frightened of things, and can help them feel a mastery over their own body, can help them feel confident. So I had to have a massive leap of faith, really, that this was the way forward. There's a great word in Danish, tillid, which means trust and faith. And I had to have this real tillid that it was going to be okay. And it kind of was.
And what about during COVID? I mean, you know, back here in the UK, we all kind of hunkered down, obviously, like we had to. And there is now a huge issue of mental health issues around certain age groups of children that obviously lived and came through that period of time, perhaps, you know, less unscathed than others. How did the Danish community respond to that? Because clearly that goes against everything we've just spoken about.
Yeah, and we went into lockdown actually a few weeks before the UK, and it was very, very weird. We were still allowed to go outside, and it's a largely agricultural country until recently, so there's still a lot of places you could just go walking in the countryside and not see anyone. There was a lot of testing. My children, they opened the kindergartens before they opened schools. So my children were able to go to daycare and kindergarten, Vuggestuen, Børnehaven, they call it. And it was very strange at the start. They were sort of in siloed with fences between them. So they stuck to the small groups, the pods. We were allowed of up to 8 people. So it was very strange. But I guess Denmark as a whole, they have this high level of trust. They're quite good at following rules. And so they followed the guidelines. And this word samfundsyn, another great Danish term, which means community mindset, really came out during the pandemic, and they found all these ways to pull together. People were helping their neighbors, just as they were all over the world. They were also doing these group sing-alongs on these televised sing-alongs on TV every day that a quarter of the population were doing. So Denmark's really? Answer to Gareth Malone, bringing the country together in singing. So it's just, yeah, that kind of, that spirit of real pull together.
That is so interesting, isn't it? It's kind of, and we'll talk about it in a bit more detail in a moment, because happiness is your other special subject. And it feels like that has a great big interplay with everything that you've just been saying. So with regards to the children and the parenting piece, what are they doing with their children, which is so groundbreaking and so different to other places in the world? I mean, I've seen you talk about the fact that they eat differently, they learn differently. I mean, what does that actually look like?
I guess from day one, there is a sense that you are bringing them up to be a member of a community. So children will go to daycare by the age of one. And in that setting, they're actually expected to do quite a lot by themselves. So from age two, they're expected to dress themselves, to go outside in snowsuits. They play outside no matter what the weather. So sleet, hail, snow, we get it all in one day here. They are encouraged to try lots of different foods. They are given quite a lot of freedom and independence, and taught to kind of look out for each other. It's not so much that there's an adult who is dictating the terms. They are really given a lot of power that the daycare staff will say, oh, you know, what should we do today? And someone might say, gosh, I really love tractors, little tiny Sven or whatever. And then they'll go on a field trip to go and look at some tractors. I mean, just they give them a lot of autonomy from a really early age in a way that I hadn't expected at all.
And how have you seen that play out in your own children? So what, you know, in terms of when you look at their sort of how they've developed and how they're growing as little people, how have you sort of seen that affect them?
Well, I mean, my kids are still not great eaters, but there is more of a sense that it's kind of hard work in the short term, because there is a real sense that children are equals. They deserve respect no matter what. They all have a voice. They kind of get to do public speaking, for example, madly from around the age of six. They stand up in school and talk about things and present in front of the class. So children are encouraged to find their voice and use it, which is exhausting in the short term, but I'm sure it's very good in the long run. There's this emphasis on Yakangod itself. I can do it myself all the time. I think being outside in all weathers has helped them, again, be quite hardy. When I see friends' children from the UK or family from the UK, there's a lot of tears when we all force everyone out in the sleet. And my kids are kind of all right with it. It's just normal to them. And they see, they're very aware of like, oh, this is good for us. It's good for our mood. Everyone gets along better. We feel better after we've been outside, even if we don't really feel like it at the time. And because they all start school so much later as well, so not till they turn six, there is much less pressure. And as a journalist, I was kind of horrified at the idea of my children not learning to read or write till often eight in Denmark, which is quite, sounds bananas when you come from the UK. But actually, there's a lot of evidence now, even from London, from education experts at Cambridge University, for example, that putting pressure on children to read before they're ready doesn't help. It causes stress, causes anxiety. And so, again, I've had to put my trust and faith in the fact that the Nordics know what they're doing. In Finland, they don't start till they turn seven. And Finland's education system is sort of the talk of the world. It's meant to be the pinnacle we're all aiming for. And OECD studies show that by the age of 15, the Nordic countries' children are at the same level or overtaking their peers. Children in Finland are doing better than kids in the UK and the US. So they all get there in the end, but they're less stressed and happier as they go. So that's been... It's been just a sort of a paradigm shift to come out of the high pressure environment that I grew up in, that I worked in London, and just see that there is another way of life and that is possible.
I think that's so true, isn't it? Because we put them under, and I suppose it's other parents do that to other parents as well. You sort of put everyone puts you and yourselves and your young ones under pressure to sort of hit various markers at various times. And children's developmental patterns, depending on which child it is so very different and so very varied. And they get boxed into a particular category of type of child, don't they, so early on in the British system. And maybe that isn't the answer. I mean, I know how hard it is to get my daughter to sit down with me and actually read. She's eight. She's seven, about to be eight. And it's impossible to get her to sit down for longer than sort of 5-10 minutes in any one sitting. And to try and do it more than three times a week is almost an impossible ask. It's really, really hard to do. But you know that if they loved it, if they really craved it and they wanted to do it, that's half the battle. And I guess forcing them to do something much earlier than they feel ready to do is why we have such a battle on our hands when we sit down and ask them to actually read to us.
Yeah, I think you're right. And certainly the way teachers here have explained it to me is that by the time you are maybe 8 or 9, there are things that you're interested in. So then, as you say, you have that motivation to learn. Whereas, I mean, I don't know about you, but Roger Red Hat was never that exciting. There's not much peril involved in reading these stories. So no wonder kids aren't that interested unless you are particularly studious and a massive people pleaser. Hello. But, you know, kids here don't tend to do that. They also, they don't, as well as having this respect, this idea that everyone is equal, you don't call teachers Miss or Sir, it's all by their first names. They have, they don't overpraise either. Mm. So rather than the idea that if we're not giving constant praise, that we're damaging our children's self-esteem. In the Nordic countries, in Denmark in particular, there's a sense that overpraise leads to inflated egos and a poor sense of self, and it can make them not be able to evaluate things for themselves. So they're always looking for external validation, which I don't know about you, but sounds very familiar to me and everyone I grew up with. And so this Nordic idea that you don't praise, you are loved just because you are, it's not your results anyone's interested in. It's your process. It's what, how you got there, your journey feels quite healthy. They don't criticize other children. They don't overpraise their own. Not every picture needs to go on the fridge, which it feels again like a very different way of looking at things.
Yeah, it feels very refreshing. What is the thing that you think you've, the sort of, not the best kept secret, I suppose, but the greatest thing that you've learned parenting over there? What's the one sort of takeaway that you would share with other people and say, if you don't do anything else, just do this because it will make a huge, huge difference?
Hoi. I think there is something around the kind of reframing what childhood looks like and what success looks like, so that it's not getting the top grades at school and burning out by the age of 16. It's as you say, allowing our children to be bored, to play, to discover their own interests, to make sure that they understand that they are loved just because, they are worthy just because. Kind of just changing the language we use around children as well. They don't call the age 2 and 3 in Denmark, they don't call them the terrible twos or threenagers. They call them the boundary age, because pushing boundaries is normal, not terrible. And I think that makes a big difference as well. It's kind of taking that time, which in our fast-paced world and the high-pressure work environments many of us are in can feel really hard. And I completely appreciate that. But having had the luxury and the privilege to see a different way of being, the idea that you can just sort of eat, play, love, repeat, and childhood can follow along that path is hugely refreshing and much more relaxing for parents and children.
Is there evidence, is there proof that raising children this way leads to creating a group of really well-adjusted adults? I mean, is there actually proof that backs all of this up? Because it makes so much sense, but is there proof?
Annoyingly, there is also proof, I'm afraid. Yes. Right. All of the kind of the UNICEF data shows that, I mean, that's what first interested me in the project, I should add, is that, as you say, I've researched into happiness. I've been studying that for the last 10 years. But then I thought, well, hang on, if the Nordic countries are always coming top of these happiness polls, how are we building these Nordic people from the ground up? How do you make a Viking? And so I kind of came at it from that position, and absolutely it backs it up that children in the Nordic countries are happier than those in the UK and the US. They are less stressed. They are higher metrics of well-being. And of course, there will always be exceptions and whataboutery and I reckon, but But studies show that the children in the Nordic countries end up happier and healthier and more independent. And actually, I was just reading a new UNICEF study that children who play outside often are much happier than those who don't. And it's really basic stuff, as you say. It's the kind of thing that perhaps our grandparents would have banged on about without so much the everyone is worthy just because, and the criticizing. But we kind of know this intuitively. And I think that's what really hits home, is that if we think about it, it makes sense and the studies back it up. So it feels like a real incentive to try and do things a little bit differently where we can. And I wanted to really focus on the things that people can take away. We can't all emigrate to the Viking countries. I am still British. I'm not going to live in Denmark forever, but I wanted exportable life lessons I could take with me wherever I ended up.
And one of those things that you've taught me is something extraordinary about Bhutan. If you listen to your TED talk and you talk about happiness, and we'll talk about that now, that is the most extraordinary scenario of how they look after their community and how they measure what's important to their culture. Just share that with everybody, because if anyone hasn't seen your TED talk, I seriously urge them to watch it, because it's fascinating, and the way that you spin things so that it really captures the imagination and interest is bang on. But just talk about Bhutan, because it is extraordinary what they're doing there.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Bhutan, back in the 1970s, the king was having an interview, I think with someone from the Financial Times of all people, and they were talking about how the country was doing. And the king said, King Wanchuk IV, he said, what's important to me is not gross national product, it's gross national happiness. And since then, every decision taken by government is filtered through the prism of, will this make people happier? And this includes happiness for individuals, but also happiness for the planet. It's this environmental prism as well. And so every policy has had to meet this criteria. And they have found in their census, that I think it's every 2 years they do, that people are, you know, reporting that they are happier, that literacy has gone up, the healthcare has improved massively, and just the fact that you can kind of twist things on its head, and that they make real decisions about things like they decided they didn't want fast food, for example. There's this sense that they can really make every decision based not on the money, but whether it is good for the people's health and happiness and the environment. So, yeah, it's very inspiring and such a different way of living to the one that most of us have become accustomed to.
I would argue that on balance, Kit Kats in moderation are not all bad.
Especially the dark,
maybe,
dark
maybe
ones,
other yeah. types of fast food, but maybe not Kit Kats, and other chocolates are available. But the happiness thing is fascinating, because we live in this culture at the moment, like you say, it's so money motivated, it's so driven by other measurements and other ways of sort of qualifying and quantifying what success looks like. But happiness has been something that you've long researched. What has been the biggest sort of thing biggest learner that's come out for you about in your research on happiness? What's been the greatest takeaway for you?
I would say that, as you say, it's become a big thing that people talk about and people think about. And I think one little mistake we've made there is that we have started to define happiness as not being sad. And that's a problem, because happiness is not something that we should be experiencing in a sort of jazz hands, rictus grin way the whole time. Happiness is delicious and beautiful, and these moments. And then we can also measure things like well-being and quality of life. Absolutely, we should be looking at those things, and work-life balance, which plays a huge part in that. But the idea that happiness is something we should be expecting all the time, that is down to the individual. I read a great quote the other day that you can't meditate your way out of a 40-hour working week without childcare. So this idea that we put it all on the individual, and if you're not happy, you're somehow broken, you're somehow wrong, when actually there are massive structural inequalities, there are massive, policy changes that are needed to help many countries to come up to a level of well-being that would offer us even the headspace to achieve higher scores on these happiness polls. So I think that's the thing, is that happiness is not the absence of being sad. Sadness is a normal human emotion that we all experience when we have loss or disappointment. And happiness as a goal, if we are thinking about it in that way, should be around well-being and contentment and a good life. Because the bad things are still, we all experience bereavements or losses in some way. So we can't shut ourselves off to that, because then we shut ourselves off to life. but pursuing the things that bring us joy and that give us a good standard of living and equality. Again, that the Nordic countries, they tax very highly, but there are higher levels of equality. And we see in countries like the US that there is a far greater reported happiness in states where there is less inequality. So even if we're doing okay, but the people around us aren't, we're probably not going to feel great. So striving for equality and for a better standard of living for everyone so that you don't have to worry your neighbour's going to rob you to put food on their table feels quite important as well.
I think that's a fundamental lesson, isn't it, though, for the bigger picture in life, in terms of, like you say, there's that you can't have one thing without the other, and you have to sort of understand that there's a balance to everything in life. And when you place sort of happiness alongside or opposite sadness, as you say, is inevitable. It has that inevitability to it. And it is, as in most things in life, how you cope with something that is an adverse scenario in your world. So how do you sort of do that? How do you best manage sadness in order to be happy?
I think it's there's a lot of acceptance there. It's accepting that it is normal. You haven't done anything wrong. You're not broken. And then allowing time for it. Almost like talking about sort of what have I learned from the Danish way of life and raising children. It's coming off that treadmill for a moment to just take a breath, to exhale, to think things through. Because again, we know this intuitively. We may have been raised in a culture that's told us, don't be sad. Or if a child falls over, we say, oh, get up again, you're okay. And that's not massively helpful either. We train people from very young out of a natural understanding of their emotions. If a child is crying, they're crying. Whether or not we think what they're crying about is justified, we have to sort of meet them where they are and see, oh yeah, that happened. That must have hurt. Probably now we'll get on with our day. So I think we can do a lot to help the next generation to be a bit more in touch with their emotions and acknowledge what's happening. I think for adults, it's about giving some time and being quite kind to ourselves and not expecting maximum productivity the day after we've just been dumped or made redundant or something like that.
Which is unfortunate because it comes to the point in the podcast when I want to ask you for a performance tip. So something that relates to people where they can go, I would be so much better if I did this every day. But I suppose what you're saying is that not to place too much expectation on yourself every day, because then you won't sort of under-accomplish, you will always overachieve. I mean, is that the problem, that we sort of set the bar in the society in which we live, we perhaps set it to an unobtainable place?
I would say that's also true, but I think I will give you one tip here, is that I think, so in the Nordic countries, there's this idea that family meals are sacred. And because of the work-life balance, it's possible to do that more often. And of course, many of us are not able to do that. But I think there's so much evidence that eating a home-cooked meal with family is associated with positive health outcomes. It's really good for our mind, body, soul, everything. So if we can aim maybe for once a week to have a home-cooked meal with the people we care about, our family, you know, gathered or blood family, I think that's a really helpful thing that kind of sets you up for the week ahead. I think that's quite a helpful one.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Helen. It's been lovely to speak with you. Really interesting.
Thank you so much. Lovely to chat to you.